Thank you for the news update. Welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service with Alan Kasuja and Nomi Iqbal. In a moment, we'll bring you up to date on what happened in France last night. One police officer was shot dead and two others injured.
And also, we'll be heading to Idaho in the United States. It's the latest on our road trips, looking at the impact of Donald Trump's presidency.
Kirsten and Vivian will be here to bring us the latest sports and business news as well. So first to France.
Mesdames et messieurs, you have to stay back, please. The area is dangerous because of shotgun. Please stay back. Mesdames et messieurs, vous reculez, s'il vous plaît.
Late last night, one policeman was killed and two seriously wounded when a man armed with an assault rifle opened fire on a police van. It took place on the Champs-Élysées.
I was walking on the pavement. There was a bus full of police. The man parked just in front of the bus, and then he got out a Kalashnikov, and then he shot six times. I thought it was fireworks. Then he went and hid behind a lorry.
We were moving towards a car, and then I heard two or three shots, but I didn't realise they were shots to start with. And well, then there was just panic all around. Everyone started running down the Champs-Élysées just by instinct. I didn't stop to work out what was going on. I just ran too.
President Francois Hollande said that he was convinced that the attack was a terrorist one, and his so-called Islamic State said that one of its fighters had carried out the attack. Olivier Guittat is with the security and counterterrorism company Global Strat. He says that the authorities were expecting an attack on a high-profile and famous target.
That's exactly the modus operandi of Islamic State that specifically targets symbols but also tourism areas. There was really a major risk of a terror attack in the run-up to the French presidential election. Both Islamic State and Al-Qaeda had called for their followers to strike France.
Well, I've been finding out more. I've been speaking to journalist David Shazam for the latest.
Well, the attack was claimed unusually swiftly by the so-called Islamic State group, and they named the attacker as Abu Yusuf al-Bajiki, Abu Yusuf the Belgian. But the information we've been getting from the prosecutors and the police is that the attacker was a 39-year-old French national with a criminal record who was sentenced to 20 years in prison in 2001 for the attempted murder of three people, including two policemen, but that sentence was then reduced in 2005 to only to only 5 years.
David, how tight is the security there this morning?
Well, security is extremely tight. Even before this attack, the government had deployed an extra 50,000 police to guard polling stations and the final rallies by the candidates in the presidential election, because the first round of voting is on Sunday. There had been fears of such an attack after the arrest of two men in Marseille on Tuesday who were accused of plotting a series of attacks in the run-up to the election. Now, those 50,000 extra police come in addition to thousands of armed soldiers and police already patrolling the streets of French cities under the state of emergency that was declared after the Paris attacks in November 2015. So, in terms of a large police presence, security is extremely strong. But I think it's interesting that the intelligence that allowed those two suspects to be arrested in Marseille on Tuesday apparently initially came from British counterintelligence. They had reportedly intercepted data exchanged between the suspects and intercepted in particular a video in which one of them pledged allegiance to the so-called Islamic State.
You mentioned the elections there. We know this is taking place on Sunday. Have the candidates reacted in any way, or any campaigns been called off?
Yes, the Conservative, the centre-right candidate, François Fillon, called for a halt to the campaigning. Other candidates expressed their condolences to the family of the policeman who was killed and expressed regret that French security forces were once again being targeted. Marine Le Pen, the leader of the anti-immigrant Front National, said that the police were once again in the firing line. Now, she has been campaigning, promising to expel from France anyone who is suspected of involvement in Islamist groups. So she's obviously going to seek to make as much political capital out of this as she can.
That's David Chazan bringing us the latest on what's happening in France.
Next, we head to the United States, the northwest state of Idaho, and it's in her last of her road trips across the USA. Newsday's Shaima Khalil is assessing the impact of President Trump's first few months in office.
Hello, Alan and Nomia. Hello from Boise, Idaho. Idaho, also known as the Gem State, a conservative state with a big rural community, a state that voted overwhelmingly for President Donald Trump. It's coming up to 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency, and Americans are taking stock of what President Trump was able to achieve in his first months in power. His opponents will tell you, not much. His supporters, however, will tell you they still feel they made the right decision putting him in the White House. We're in downtown Boise. Boise is the capital of Idaho, and it couldn't be more different than its actual rural surroundings. This is a buzzing, bustling area with restaurants, shops, and university, you know, student body. Really cool stuff. I'm not very far from an area called Freak Alley. I've been taken to that, and it did scare me in the beginning, but it's actually an alley with all sorts of really cool graffiti and street art. If you want to know what it looks like, I've tweeted some pictures. A big Basque community here, very, very diverse in Boise. It's also been described as a blue area or a blue island in a big red state. This is a state that loves nature. There are forests in the north and there are deserts in the south. And we traveled to the north to speak to a logger. The timber industry is a big employer in the north part of the state. Logging is a crucial part of that. So I spent time at a logging yard and spoke to the boss there, Mark Mohan. He spoke about the challenging facing his business, his argument against the environmentalists, and what he makes of Donald Trump's presidency so far.
I'm Mark Mahon. I'm a third-generation logger from Council, Idaho. I've lived here all of my 45 years. I'm the woods boss for Mahon Logging. When I graduated, you know, 25 years ago, you could pick your job wherever you wanted to go. Unfortunately now, our greatest export from Council are our young people. There's virtually no jobs available for young people.
Does that have to do with the decline of the industry, of the timber industry and the logging?
Yeah, we just do not have the accessibility to the forest that we used to. Adams County, where we're at, is two-thirds owned by the federal government. I look at it as this way. They own two-thirds of the land, so they are controlling two-thirds of the entrepreneurial opportunities for us.
For an independent business like yourself, you're saying that there is less chance for you to log because the federal government doesn't allow logging in the land that it owns.
No, the federal government allows the logging, but they are handcuffed through environmental laws, this process of red tape and planning. And
but let me put that point of view to you, and I'm sure you've heard it before, but any environmentalist hearing you would say, well, wait a minute, what you're asking is for a chance to cut off more trees. And from an environmental point of view, you're destroying the wildlife, you're destroying the forests. And, you know, it's the federal government's job to protect the environment, to protect those forests.
But by leaving the forests for themselves, they're not protecting them. There are too many trees growing per acre. So by thinning out the total number of trees, we are being able to better allocate the nutrients and the moisture to the trees that we want, the healthiest, the proper species for that site.
Let me ask you about President Donald Trump, because obviously he came out with a lot of promises, bringing jobs back, but also, you know, his environmental policies that have become very controversial. How much of that do you follow, and what do you make of it?
We are a true supporter of Donald Trump and his desire to make operating in businesses easier and allowing us to be more successful. Following his election, we went out and immediately made two purchases to upgrade new equipment.
Really?
Because
you felt that reassured that things are going to look up after his election?
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that President Trump has always said is that the real America or the rest of America has been forgotten by Washington. And to be honest, standing here in Council, Idaho, Washington feels like a world away.
Well, I definitely feel there is a huge disconnect. It just seems contradictory that the decisions are being made in Washington, D.C. that are affecting policy out in the West, and they're stuck in office buildings.
You're saying that people who are making decisions about your business don't really understand your business.
That's what I'm saying. I would love to have the opportunity to have Donald Trump for a day and just show him that as the most powerful man in the West, he has control over these lands. And as a businessman, why are we going to spend millions and millions of dollars fighting fires when we can harvest it, put people to work, and make products?
Will you let him split a log?
He can do whatever he wants. Just as long as he doesn't tweet about it.
Thank you. Mark Mohan there, also known as the Woods Boss. See, that's the beauty of this job. You know, you go around trying to talk politics and focusing on the issues, and then you bump into the Woods Boss. How great is that? Mark there speaking about issues facing the timber industry, forest management and land management, and I want to hear more about that from my two guests. I'm here with Tom Michael, General Manager of Boise State Public Radio. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
And I'm also here with Jacqueline Kettler, political scientist at Boise State University. Thank you so much for joining us, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
Tom, I'm going to start with you. You heard Mark there talk about the lack of jobs, the challenges facing the logging industry, and the fact that the federal government owns a lot of the land, which means less chances for people to log. Is that a big story that you cover on your radio station?
It sure is. This is an extractive industry. It's an old industry, logging. Just last week, I spoke to a fellow who was raising sheep, and he was chafing against what he thought were excessive environmental regulations. Just things took longer for him to do his job.
Yeah. And Jacqueline, tell us more about the state policy on this, because it does look like it's a very crucial part of life in northern Idaho, but life is being made very difficult for them.
Sure, and the debates about public land are definitely big ones in the West, and there's been a movement by some to move some federal land to the states, transfer.
It's a big debate here.
Yes, definitely. But you get some interesting coalitions of groups working against it, including groups, conservative groups, environmental groups, who don't want to lose access to the public lands.
Something really interesting that I picked up from talking to Mark is how he feels about Washington, D.C. And he said, do you know what? Those folks in Washington, D.C., the people making decisions about our industry, don't understand life here, don't understand our industry. And Tom, I'm just wondering, is that something you hear from listeners, the fact that there's a disconnect between their lives and the Capitol?
Not even just from listeners. I listened to the governor's wife, Lori Otter, during the lighting of the Christmas tree at the State House just a few blocks away.
Right.
And just to show you, Shaima, how small this state is, after she lit the Christmas tree, she invited everyone to come in for hot chocolate. I mean,
right.
You can't do that in other states. This is urban-rural divide, which is the American story writ large here in Idaho. And certainly part of that is just the difference in the access to these rural lands.
And Jacqueline, is that contrast of what Tom was talking about, the rural and the urban, do you hear a lot of that when you speak to your students at Boise State University?
I mean, I think some from Idaho definitely pick up on it, especially when the legislature's in session, and a lot there are policies that end up with an urban-rural divide, like transportation. And so in those issues, I do see students in class will be noting the differences. And so a lot of our students are from Oregon that actually has some of the same issues for urban-rural divide.
Tom, tell me about the first 100 days of the Donald Trump presidency. Newsrooms across the United States, but also across the world, are obviously building up for that. How are you looking at this, and what are the issues that have come up
So November 5th, we thought we would see the rise of maybe more militia groups like we saw in the first Clinton administration with a new Clinton administration here in Idaho. That didn't happen. Instead, we're telling an entirely different story. And it's really interesting because people care about cabinet things that, you know, they didn't focus on maybe 4 or 8 years ago. This is fascinating times.
It's amazing because we were talking about and you were naming, you know, cabinet members. It's like who would have done that, you know, during the last administration?
People really are focused on what's happening on a day-to-day, drip-by-drip basis.
Tom and Jacqueline, thank you so much for joining us. Lots and lots of issues to discuss here in Idaho. And even though Washington is miles and miles and miles away, what happens there makes a whole lot of difference to many, many people around this state that backed Donald Trump and saw him get into the White House.
Shaima, great. And we look forward to hearing a bit more from Shaima. Stay with us throughout the program. And you're listening to Newsday, and we're coming to you live from London. It's Alan Kasuja and Nomia Iqbal, and Shaima is in Idaho.
She is in Idaho. Just to let you know of some other stories this morning, sticking with the US, Arkansas has executed its first inmate in 12 years. This has come from a prison spokesman. Convicted murderer Ledell Lee had maintained his innocence. So five appeals were made by his lawyers yesterday, but they'd been rejected. The whole thing's caused huge controversy because the state had planned to carry out 8 executions in 11 days before its supply for lethal injection drug runs out at the end of the month. The lower court blocked that move, but the Supreme Court has now overturned it. And also just another story, the arrest of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is a priority for the US. That's what the America's Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, is saying. Mr. Assange has not left Ecuador's embassy in London since he walked through the door seeking political asylum in June 2012. Kirsten Webster is here with the sports news. Marcus Rashford continues to be a superstar.
He does. I understand you have quite a personal connection with him.
Well, my mum knows his father.
Oh, well, there you go. You're almost related, and you should be very proud. Manchester United are through to the semi-final of the Europa League, beating Anderlecht 2-1 after extra time at Old Trafford to go through 3-2 on aggregate. The victory was crucial for United, who do see the Europa League as a potential route to the Champions League next season, away from the battle for top four places in the Premier League. But the win came at a huge cost, with potentially serious knee injuries to Marcos Rojo and Zlatan Ibrahimovic. United manager Jose Mourinho fears the worst.
I want to wait, but my feeling is not good for both. I want to wait and I want to try to be optimistic, but I'm not.
Lyon, Celta Vigo and Ajax all won their ties and go into Friday's draw. In about half an hour, we'll hear from the former Trinidad and Tobago captain Dwight York, who has told the BBC World Service's World Football Programme that black footballers should go on strike to force the sports authorities to take a serious look at the lack of black managers in the game. And the Indiana Pacers threw away a 26-point lead to lose Game 3 of their playoff to the Cleveland Cavaliers in the best-of-seven Eastern Conference playoff. The Cavs now have a lead of 3-0. And Tiger Woods is likely to miss the rest of the PGA Tour season after announcing he's had a fourth surgery on his back. The recovery time is usually about 6 months.
Thank you very much for that. Let's now switch our focus to business news. 24 after 6 o'clock here in London. And one of the biggest banks in the world, Deutsche Bank, has been fined millions of dollars over its foreign exchange practices. Vivian Nunes is here from our business desk. What did Deutsche Bank do wrong?
Well, according to the US Federal Reserve, which regulates the US banking sector, Deutsche Bank used unsafe and unsound practices in foreign exchange markets. Excuse me. It failed to address the fact that its traders used electronic chat rooms to communicate with competitors about their trading positions. And for that, the bank's been fined $137 million. Separately, it's also been fined nearly $20 million for failing to maintain an adequate compliance program of the Volcker Rule. Now, that's a rule that prohibits banks from making certain kinds of investments with their own accounts. Now, as well as these fines, the Fed has ordered Deutsche Bank to improve its oversight procedures when it comes to those foreign exchange trading markets.
So not very good a day for Deutsche Bank, but also not a good day for Barbie either.
No, sales have fallen for Barbie by 13% in the first 3 months of this year. Now, overall sales for Mattel are also down. They're down by 15%. Mattel is the company that makes Barbie, and it's actually the largest toy company in the world. It made $730 million in sales for the first quarter of this year, but that was below the expectation, which was more like $800 million. It hasn't been all bad news for Barbie lately. Last year, in the first 9 months, sales actually increased. And you might remember that was when Mattel launched a new range of the dolls that had different skin tones, different body shapes, that kind of thing. But that good luck hasn't kept going. Over Christmas, Mattel was forced to slash prices for Barbies. That was because there was lots of stock left over after the Christmas season. And that, combined with these weak first quarter sales, has meant a loss for Mattel worth $113 million.
And I've also been reading that Tesla is recalling some of its cars. Why?
Yeah, this is a voluntary recall for Tesla's Model S and Model X cars. And this is over a problem with the parking brake. And Tesla says about 2% of the 50,000 vehicles that were built between February and October last year were affected. All of those are being recalled, though. And it hasn't been an accident that's triggered this. Tesla are just saying that there could be a problem with a small gear in one of these parking brakes that was manufactured by a third-party supplier. But it's going to be getting in touch with all the customers who bought those cars to let them know how their brakes can be replaced.
Vivian Nunes, thank you very much. It's 6:26 here in London.
Now, we're going to tell you about the discovery of treasure. This was hidden inside a piano. Happened in the English county of Shropshire. Piano tuner Martin Backhouse takes up the story now of how he discovered hundreds of gold coins inside.
My first amazement when I opened the piano, I thought, oh, this is just mothballs specifically wrapped, which you used to get in old pianos. But this time it was, this looks a bit odd. I thought, well, I better open one. And what happened then was that with my pen, I carefully opened, I thought, oh, this is interesting material. So I prized open one end and thought, oh, this looks like gold to me. Well, I'd never come across gold like this before. And I thought, something serious here. So I actually put it back in the piano, put the casework parts back on and went to see Cathy Dowbiggin down at the office. Said, I think you better come with me. I think there's something important. And please bring the headmaster as well. And they looked very, very worried and came down with me to the hall. I said, it's not too serious, but it is a serious matter. And when I took the casework parts off and showed them, it was just sort of, wow, what do we do now? Mine was just boggling. You know, I've never come across anything like this in my whole life. People say, well, why didn't I sell the piano? Or, you know, say, oh, I'll give you a new piano. But no, that's not right, because I just got to be very conscientious on this, and it belonged to the school as far as I was concerned, and I want to help the school as much as I can.
Well, the college's headmaster got in contact with the Hemmings family, which had recently donated the piano, assuming it was their gold. Here's Meg Hemmings' response.
We gave it to the college and the piano tuner found it, so all schools are in need of funding, so that is the best outcome, yes. I hope they will do something that will benefit the children's musical ability. So I think we feel very strongly about that.
Have you ever found any treasure? This doesn't happen to me, Nomi. I'm not sure about you.
Never.
But here's
probably
our
about
text line.
£5 down the sofa.
+447 786 20 50 85. Have you found treasure? We want to hear from you.
This is the BBC World Service, where we find out just how good it is to talk.
Life stories.
There's only one thing in life that's certain, death. When was the last time you spoke about it?
I wish death weren't so darn scary.
But there's a movement hoping to change that. Death Cafe, a social franchise that has spread across the world, aiming to break down the fear of mortality, where people come together to eat cake, drink tea, and discuss death.
It started with my sister passing away. To this day, I still actually don't know what happened.
I'm Julian Keane. I'll be discovering how Death Cafe began, exploring the theory that we live better lives when we embrace our mortality.
We are going to die, doesn't matter what. So we start to live better.
Dying to Talk, Sunday at 13 GMT.
Hello, this is Newsday from the BBC World Service with Nomi Iqbal and Alan Kasuja.
And this half hour, the Zimbabwean priest who called for political change, will he be sent to jail?
3 months after Cameroon cut off the internet, the president wants it switched back on.
And it's been 90 days of President Trump. We're in Idaho finding out how his policies are going down with Americans.
Also, a former Manchester United footballer is calling on black players to go on strike. All that on the way, but first, the latest news.
BBC News with Fiona MacDonald.
The French President François Hollande is to chair a meeting of his defence cabinet to discuss the security threat to Sunday's presidential election, following another jihadist attack in Paris in which a police officer was killed. Two others were wounded when a gunman opened fire on a police bus on one of the city's main streets. He kept firing as he tried to flee but was shot dead by police. French media say the suspect was a 39-year-old French national. Police have searched the suspect's home in the eastern suburbs of Paris and are investigating whether he had any accomplices. Three leading election candidates have cancelled campaign events in the wake of the attack. The far-right leader Marine Le Pen, as well as centrist Emmanuel Macron and the conservative François Fillon, have called off rallies on what would have been the last day of campaigning. Prison authorities in the US state of Arkansas say they've carried out their first execution of an inmate for more than a decade. The death by lethal injection of Liddell Lee is the first of several imminent executions planned by the state authorities. Supplies of one drug they use in the procedure apparently expire at the end of the month. The US Supreme Court decision to proceed with the execution was made only 30 minutes before his death warrant expired. An Egyptian-American charity worker detained in Cairo for 3 years on charges of human trafficking has been flown home to the United States. Aya Hijazi was acquitted last week. Reports say President Trump had asked his Egyptian counterpart to help resolve the case. And the former South African president, Kgalema Motlanthe, says he's not sure if he can support the African National Congress, led by his successor, Jacob Zuma, at the next election. Mr. Motlanthe said his vote for the ANC could not be taken as a given in 2019. BBC News.
Thanks, Fiona, for the news update. Welcome to Newsday with Alan Kasuja and Nomi Rickbell. This half hour, it's been 90 days of President Trump. We'll be back in rural Idaho in the northwest of the USA with Newsday's Shaima Khalil, who's finding out how people think Mr. Trump is doing.
Also, a story which is unfolding while we are on air. A 28-year-old man has been arrested in Germany over the attack on the Dortmund team bus. The German papers are reporting that the motive was financial, that man had bought shares in the club and was hoping to make money by the share price falling. We'll have more details as they become available. We start in Cameroon, where the President Paul Biya has announced that internet services are going to be switched back on 3 months after they were cut off in English-speaking areas. The government blocked access after protests by Anglophone people against discrimination in the majority Francophone country. The unrest really kicked off following a decision to impose the use of French in schools and in the courts. Judith Nwama is a telecommunications expert who also works for the World Bank and comes from Bamenda, which is one of the areas affected in Cameroon.
It came as a shock the way it happened when it was taken off, and then it's just come back on as well. And it's been a welcome relief, although some of us are not that overjoyed because we believe it was just a right that was taken away, and somehow the government has come back to its senses and given back us our rights.
And it all started on the 17th of January. Just looking at your Twitter feed, I see the pinned tweet on your feed is, help us tweet and share, internet shutdown in southern Cameroon. And the hashtag there is bring back our internet. It must have impacted lives very much.
Yes, it did. It's been a real nightmare, especially for the tech industry. I don't know if you ever heard of the Silicon Mountain. It's in Boya, the southwest region of Cameroon. And it really affected the tech industry, which was just trying to set up itself and get going.
So, and it's not just businesses, it's also lives. It's also banking, isn't it?
It was everything. Cash flow was affected, healthcare. So you can imagine people, doctors or hospitals that were doing research or collaboration. A lot of us send remittances back home to family members. That was affected as well. Education, people had scholarship deadlines that they missed. So it affected everybody.
But despite the problems that were encountered, despite the fact that this internet was switched off, there were also some amazing stories of resilience and success, weren't there?
Yes, an example really, the guy who won the Google competition, and he had been doing the competition online, and fortunately for him, he submitted his details, I think a couple of days before the internet shutdown happened, and he had to travel out of the zone.
So literally,
to be able to follow what was happening.
For you to be able to get internet at all in the Cameroon at that point, you needed to leave the south of the country to travel to other parts of the country.
Yes, and I don't know if you heard about the internet refugee camp that was created in the border between the southwest region and the littoral region. So literally a refugee camp was created there by some of the tech entrepreneurs. So you could come there, camp at the border, because they could get signal.
What measures are in place at the moment to make sure that the government doesn't do this again? Because it could actually switch it off whenever it wants, given what it's already done.
That's something that everybody is thinking about. And our hope is that the international community is taking into account what's going on. The group that looks after IP addresses, they're now trying to put a motion in place where governments that shut down internet, they will withhold IP addresses from them. So not just stop giving them IP addresses, but I think if they infringe on this for a couple of times in 10 years, they will actually take the IP resources that they've actually been offered. So we're hoping that things like that come into play such that governments do have some punitive measures when they decide to shut down the internet.
And for someone like you, I wonder, when was the last time you received a WhatsApp from that region, a WhatsApp message?
January 17th, I got a WhatsApp message, and after that it was blank. And then today, it's been nonstop.
Ping, 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 and
I mean, and a lot of us communicated back home via WhatsApp because it's cheaper. It was really, really affecting communications between families, between friends. We had lots of WhatsApp groups with our mates back home. So today it's been like, what's going on? What's the news out there? And it's almost as if people traveled and they're back from vacation. And it's rather unfortunate that in this day and age, when we all think internet, it's a right, that it can be used so easily to marginalize people.
Judith Nwama, telecoms expert, works for the World Bank, speaking to me about Cameroon and the internet switching back and now switching back on.
Let's head to South Africa. We're hearing a lot about the growing pressure on the government of President Jacob Zuma. And now another voice has been added to that criticism, that of the former president, Kgalema Motlanthe, who was Zuma's immediate predecessor. He's been talking to our correspondent, Karen Allen, and predicts that in the election in 2019, the African National Party could lose its parliamentary majority.
I think we'll see the ANC lose its majority. It will definitely muster less than 50% plus one. And it's primarily because, you know, you're dealing here with incorrigibility. You see, if you were dealing with one indiscretion and having to manage that and recover from it, it would be manageable. Problem is that it doesn't stop. You know, every month you are confronted by a new problem. And the problems revolve around the same individual.
Would it be enough for you to actually switch parties?
Well, I would imagine that at some point, you know, those of us who are diehards and who have, you know, given all our lives to the organization, we'll reach a point where we need a realignment of allegiance.
The way you're feeling at the moment, can your vote be counted on for the ANC come 2019, or that's not a given?
I don't know yet. It's not a given because, you know, we are forever snowed under an avalanche of wrongdoing and you know, at some point there'll be a tipping point here.
And look, let's be bold. You've made it clear you have no interest in standing for office as a presidential candidate. Have you made your mind yet as to who is likely to be the best choice for the ANC and who's going to give the ANC the best chance to win in 2019?
For now, I really, you know, pray for just honesty and integrity. As to who embodies that, it's really of less interest to me. But for now, I think, you know, anyone who's honest and is upright would be a major, major improvement here.
That's the former South African President Motlanthe speaking there to our correspondent Karen Allen.
And let's return now to Shema Khalil, who is in the rural northwest state of Idaho for Newsday. And Shema, you've been taking stock of what people there make of Donald Trump's presidency as he approaches his first 100 days in office. The boss of a logging company earlier voiced his concerns. It was quite interesting listening to him. Who else have you been talking to?
Yeah, the Woods boss was talking to us, and he wanted to meet the commander-in-chief. I also spoke to two refugees, Marwan Sweden, he's from Iraq, he's been in the United States since 2008, and Asma from Syria. She arrived in America in 2014. Now, they both fled the chaos of war and are glad to be safe in the United States. And Asma started by telling me about the homeland she left behind and the challenges she's facing.
Home is when you find safety. When I was in Syria and I felt somehow I will be killed or my kids, one of my kids will be killed, I didn't feel home at all. When I left and stayed in Egypt, and I was scared because single mom in Egypt is really challenging. I feel home here because it's only I am safe. Some challenging, for sure. There is people hate Muslims. I am from Syria and I didn't change my culture. I integrate very well.
And you're wearing the hijab, the headscarf.
Yes,
it's a beautiful purple, by the way, you're wearing.
Thank you. But for me, I integrate in my way. I don't change the rules I grow up with.
You know, in the last 12 months or even more with, you know, President Trump, back then presidential candidate Trump, his rhetoric, the way that he spoke about Muslims, the way that he spoke about the region, the Middle East especially, but also, you know, in progression when he came to power, his policies, the ban on people from certain Muslim countries, including Syria and Iraq. I mean, Iraq now is off the list. How does that sit with you? I mean, do you feel that it's become worse for you? Has it not made a difference? How do you view that, Marwan?
It didn't make a difference, really. I've been here 10 years, the three elections, and I kind of had an idea about election season. In election season, your goal is to get elected. It's a marketing campaign. President Trump get elected, nothing get changed, or not a new policy was implemented aside from the ban, which was expected and was practiced by the previous administrations, by the way. It's not the first time. Life is the same. Life is going on, business as usual.
And what about you, Asma?
Well, to be honest, I'm scared. I'm scared because I ran away from the violence. I ran away from discrimination. I hate discrimination. I love everybody. So when I see someone, no matter if he's the president or anyone, specifically about somebody like Syrian specifically or Egyptian specifically or whatever, I don't like it at all. I feel when I heard anything about Syrian being bombing here or bombing there, I really scared.
And Marwan, I guess you've been living through this for a decade, because you've lived through the war in Iraq and then you moved to the United States and been watching it for years. What's that been like for you?
Just frustration. And you know, things will get only worse. And I hope they just hold the Iraqi government accountable for a lot of actions. To be honest, if the Arab leaders would intervene early with the Syrian issues, it wouldn't reach to that limit.
President Trump was adamant about the number of refugees that he was going to accept in the United States. You know, if you have a message for him about that, you know, would you tell him anything?
My first perspective about United States is a really welcoming country. And I hope this perspective stay like that.
What do you say to people who, you know, might be listening to you and say, but the thing is, we're not against refugees per se, but there are certain security issues that we have to consider. And we can't just let everybody in, because that would mean that our country is not safe.
Before I come to United States, I had at least 10 interviews. They ask me a lot of questions. They run background check also for my kids, even they are kids. So it's not for us like, this is your visa, congratulations.
Come in.
Come in. You have to wait and you have to be patient.
Would you ever go back to Iraq?
I do love the United States. It's a really beautiful country. I've been around 24 states. I really love the people. I have a lot of friends. But I buried my heart in Iraq. You need to understand that. And Iraq, we have roots there. And our roots is back to 10,000 years. I wish I can, but again, not in this political climate.
Thank you both very much.
Marwan and Esma there. Marwan from Iraq and Esma from Syria, speaking about a homeland they left behind, speaking about the challenges of living in the United States as refugees, and about some concern over the Donald Trump refugee and immigration policies there. We're discussing the lead up to the 100 days of the Trump administration, and I'm here with Emily Larson, a student of political science in Boise State University. Emily, thank you for joining us. And I'm also here with Tom Michael, General Manager of Boise State Public Radio. Tom, thank you for being here with us.
Great to be with you, Shaiba.
You heard Marwan and Esma there talking about their lives in the United States. I'm just wondering, Emily, you also heard Donald Trump's rhetoric about immigration, about border control, the travel ban with his executive order. What do you make of that?
I know that there's been a lot of criticism as far as his rhetoric being discriminatory, and I think if you look below the surface and try and understand what the travel ban means and what his executive orders pertaining to this issue have indicated, it is truly an issue of national security and making sure that Americans stay safe during this time when people are fearful about the consequences of terrorism.
But doesn't that also come in contrast with what America is all about? I mean, you heard Esma there saying, you know, home is where I feel safe, and even though Syria is my homeland, I didn't feel like it was home anymore. Boise's now home because I feel safe. Can you imagine how many thousands, if not millions, of Syrians would want the same chance like Esma? Mm-hmm.
And I completely understand that, you know, there's a trade-off here with we want to be welcoming to all these people in our country. America has always been a country of immigrants, and we cherish that. But the reality of the situation is that we are in a dangerous time when we have people coming in from other countries that are invoking terrorism on our soil. And we are seeing this all throughout the world, that it's becoming a problem. And so really it comes to a time when we have to kind of sit down and look at the options that we have, and I think that Trump's travel ban has kind of been the first step to that.
Tom, you know, there's a sizable refugee community here. Esma and Marwan are two of the people that we spoke to. I'm just wondering how much of it as a story features, you know, with your listeners, with your day-to-day coverage. How big a story is it for you?
It's a huge story. It's a refugee community here in Boise, but also nearby in Twin Falls. Mm-hmm. If you think about that, it's a real flashpoint to what we're talking about, where there's a lot of tensions about immigrants, and yet you have the Turkish owner and immigrant of Chobani, one of the largest yogurt manufacturers in the U.S., who is running a company there. You have Clif Bar. You have a lot of food processing in that town, and yet you also have the far-right news organization Breitbart writing somewhat sensationalistic stories about Twin Falls, Idaho. So it's a real flashpoint for people in southern Idaho.
And I'm wondering if there's also a contrast. You talked about the contrast between the city of Boise and its rural surroundings, and I'm just wondering the sentiments towards refugees. Is Boise more welcoming, for example, to refugees, to the idea of people coming into the country more, for example, than rural Idaho in the north or the south?
Oh, I would think that's true. And you have also agencies that are more supportive within Boise. And the mayor has been out front about being a refugee
right.
community. You don't have to go too far, Shaima, outside of Boise to get differing opinions about this story.
Emily, is that something that, you know, you as a student, and I understand, of course, you're a Republican, what kind of conversations are you having with your friends and your colleagues, not just about the refugee issue, but generally about the 100 days of President Trump?
Among my Republican peers and colleagues, I think we've been generally favorable towards the performance of the president thus far.
You're not concerned, for example, about his low approval ratings?
It's, you know, he came in with very low approval ratings, and so it's really hard to come back from that. It'll be interesting to kind of see what happens, but so far we've been pleased with the things like Justice Gorsuch's nomination, and that's something that I think was a big priority for everyone, so we're happy with that.
Emily and Tom, thank you so much. A lot of those issues, you know, the issues that we've been discussing, the scuffles in the White House, you know, about policy, about different issues do trickle down here in the day-to-day lives. We've been looking at the 100 days and the view from Idaho here in the northwest of the United States.
And we look forward to hearing a lot more stuff that Chairman Halil has prepared for us as she continues to assess the impact of Donald Trump's presidency ahead of his 100th day in office.
Listening to Newsday with Nomi Rickbell and Alan Kasuja. A reminder of the headlines this morning. France's President Francois Hollande is to chair a meeting of his defence cabinet shortly later today to discuss the security threat to Sunday's presidential election. It follows another attack last night where one police officer was killed. Details of that still to be confirmed, exactly who was behind it. Also, German police have arrested a man on Friday who's suspected of having planted a bomb on the bus of football team Borussia Dortmund last week. The suspect has dual German and Russian nationality and is accused of attempted murder, inflicting serious bodily harm and causing an explosion. And also, the American state of Arkansas has carried out its first execution since 2005. It's all part of its controversial plan to execute several prisoners before a drug expires. Let's get the sports news with Kirsten.
Manchester United are through to the semi-final of the Europa League, beating Anderlecht 2-1 after extra time at Old Trafford to go through 3-2 on aggregate. But the win came at a huge cost, with potentially serious knee injuries to Marcos Rojo and Zlatan Ibrahimovic. United have been reliant on the Swedes' goals this season, but arguably Rojo's injury is more worrying for boss Jose Mourinho. United have other strikers, but with Chris Smalling and Phil Jones also injured, they're running out of defenders. Mourinho called on the two English players to hurry their return.
And I think it's time for Jones and Smalling to be brave, to risk, because for the team, you have to do everything. That's the way I think. You cannot do miracles, so miracles I don't expect, but you have to try to do everything to accelerate the process.
Two other Europa League quarterfinals went to extra time. Ajax fought back with 10 men to beat the German club Schalke 4-3 on aggregate, while Lyon knocked out Besiktas on penalties. Celta Vigo's 1-1 draw with Genk was enough to see the Spanish club through over two legs. The draw for the semi-finals of the Europa League and Champions League will be made later today. To basketball, the Cleveland Cavaliers have completed a stunning comeback to overhaul what at one stage was a 26-point lead for the Indiana Pacers. A 119-114 win leaves them one game away from the conference semifinals.
Look at the excitement of my teammates after we won the game. To win on the road in the postseason is already tough enough. And for us to win in the fashion we did tonight is even tougher. So, you know, I don't think as a group we don't take that for granted. And we showed that emotion, you know, after the clock went to zero.
That was LeBron James. And LeBron James also picked up an NBA milestone in that match, passing Kobe Bryant to become the third highest scoring player in NBA postseason history. Only Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Michael Jordan have more. The Milwaukee Bucks are on court against the Toronto Raptors and on course to take a 2-1 lead in their series. Tiger Woods has had another operation on his back, his fourth, and it's likely to rule him out for the rest of the PGA Tour season. The 14-time major winner says he needed more relief from back and neck pain. Ethiopia's Fahi Lalisa says he'll make an anti-government sign again if he achieves success at the London Marathon this weekend. The Olympic silver medalist is living in exile in the USA, saying he's scared that he'd be killed if he returns home because of the gesture he made on the podium in Rio.
Automatically they kill me. If they not kill me, they put in jail. If not put in jail, they close in airport. I cannot see any other country ever again. How can I regret? I come from the people. My people is dying still. I never regret. I never regret. I will make again stronger.
The Ethiopian government maintains he'd be welcomed as a hero if he were to return. going to stay with you for a moment because the former Trinidad and Tobago captain Dwight Yorke has called on black footballers to go on strike to force football authorities to take a serious look at the lack of black managers. In an exclusive interview with the BBC's World Football Programme, Yorke revealed he's been trying to get a coaching job since he retired 8 years ago, but he hasn't even been able to get an interview. He says other black players have decided not to bother getting their coaching badges because they know they wouldn't be able to get a job, so they don't want to waste their time. He spoke to Rafael Gala.
I have worked on television as a sports analyst. I've done my coaching badges. And I've interacted with various people who are aspiring to be managers one day, in particular black players as well that I've interacted with and had conversation with, ex-players who refuse to do the badges because of they honestly feel that they're not going to be given a chance. Now, you look through the 92 English teams that are in the country, I think there is only three black managers. And I think, you know, maybe black players may have to go on strike. It's been over a decade or more now that we haven't seen black managers. Now, for me to make such a comment, I wouldn't just make it because it's me personally. It's got nothing to do with me personally. But the evidence are there for everyone to see. Now, if you were saying to me that, Dwight, you haven't done your badges or you're not interested in being a manager, that's a different thing. But there's people out there who, black players, who wants to be managers, but I know for a fact I've not even been given that opportunity. Now, my question to everyone, football is such a global sport, and black players have contributed to the global sport for a number of years, a high percentage of black players. Now, I can say to you directly that there is no black managers. Look through the Premier League. Is there any black managers? Look through the Italian league. Is there any black managers? And the list goes on. The La Liga, the Germans, you know, go back in, even to America, maybe one Patrick Vieira I can think of had that break through his link because of Manchester City. So we know that. But don't tell me, you know, that there is only three black managers in the whole of the football league in England when there is a high percentage of black players that I know personally who are desperately want to get into management. So if it's not because of our color of our skin, then tell me what.
Why do you think that is, and how can things change? In the United States, you have specific rules that make it, that push it, the Rooney Rule, exactly.
Well, somebody like, I mean, I'm speaking out about it. It took me 8 years to really come to terms in terms of, nah, this is not really it. You know, we either, you know, we'll be given a chance, you know, people like myself who is obviously, you know, have a good credibility in the game, who's done this and played at the very top level throughout my career. You think, yeah, you'll get a job or at least be given an interview, but you're not even getting an interview. Be fair to what management is all about. You know, at least give us an interview. Tell me as an individual what I need to do. Do I need to go back? Maybe I need to start lower, so I need to get some experience here or there. But I've seen managers with my own eyes right now at present are walking out of jobs, walking back into jobs, walking, getting sacked, and walking back into another job, and yet we can't even get an interview. So I see it as not being fair. And if it's not my color of my skin, then what it is?
And that's Dwight Yorke speaking to Rafael Geller there. And very difficult to come back from what he's saying, isn't there? Those positions he's taken are quite powerful.
They are powerful, and it's something that the NFL looked at in America, and maybe it's time that soccer did the same, football did the same.
Thank you very much for that. Kirsten Webster with the sports news. This is Newsday. We're coming to you live from London, and it's Nomia and Alan.
This is the BBC World Service, and on the inquiry this week...
Almost 2 billion people have Facebook profiles, but many of us don't realise how many...